Richard Lechick, on behalf of Mary Spihar, the appellant mother, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Three? Okay.
The Due Process Clause of Article 1, Section 3 categorically requires that parents in termination of parental rights proceedings be appointed counsel at public expense. Because children also have the same due process stakes at issue in termination of parental rights proceedings, they also have a categorical right to counsel at public expense in termination of parental right proceedings. Because Ms. Spihar's motion was erroneously denied to appoint counsel to her 9-year-old son, this court should reverse the termination of her parental rights. Precedent establishes that Article 1, Section 3 provides more protection in this area than the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Specifically, the Lushire and Myricks case rely on Article 1, Section 3 in holding that parents are categorically required to be appointed counsel. In contrast, the United States Supreme Court has held that we conduct a balancing test under the 14th Amendment as to whether parents should be provided counsel at public expense in termination proceedings. The Supreme Court has implicitly reaffirmed this holding in the Grove case, where they use language stating that it's inappropriate to balance, to have sort of this balancing test when there's a liberty interest of the parent-child relationship at stake. And this court in the GG opinion also stated that the United States Supreme Court's holding had undermined the underpinnings of the Lushire and Myricks case. And there are good policy justifications for why guardian ad litems and children and CASAs don't mitigate the risk of error by not appointing counsel to children. Unlike guardian ad litems, attorneys represent the actual interests of the child. And unlike a guardian ad litem, attorneys have the obligation to consult with the child and learn what they want and what their interests are. Guardian ad litems actually have no duty to do so. What they have a duty to do is to report on what they might learn the child wants.
In this case, what would an attorney have been able to do for this 9-year-old child that wasn't served in this particular case?
Well, an attorney would have consulted with MS. MS was a child 9 years old. While he had behavioral difficulties, there wasn't any indication that he had, you know, intellectual disabilities. He read well, by all accounts. You know, it would have been another voice for the court. It would have added to our adversarial system, where we pit lawyers for the parents and the department at one another, and then we have a guardian ad litem who gives his or her opinion on the best interest of the child. So it would have, as an advocate for the child, viewing the testimony and could have cross-examined witnesses, could have presented evidence, could have challenged evidence or assertions by witnesses, and would have provided a check on not only the department, but the parent and the guardian ad litem. And in this case, it's particularly a significant risk of error, because in this case, the guardian ad litem actually thought she didn't have a duty to report on what the child wanted. So not only did she not investigate, which I guess the statute doesn't mandate that she do an investigation as to what the child wants, but she would have not been, she didn't think she was obligated to report what MS wanted. So what this leads to is that there's a significant difference between attorneys and guardian ad litems, and the legislature has made findings on what attorneys can do as opposed to guardian ad litems. They found that they will, one, ensure that the child's voice is considered. They'll engage the child in the legal proceedings. They'll explain to the child his or her rights. They'll counsel the child and explain the consequences of different decisions and, you know, how we might approach this differently. And they provide accountability to the system.
But the issue is whether or not the relationship's terminated. Aren't those two positions, yes and no, represented?
There is advocacy on both sides for whether termination, that is the ultimate issue in the termination petition. But an attorney for a child would add to that discussion, just as a guardian ad litem does.
But this isn't an independent action for a child to terminate their parents.
That's true. I mean, in this case, children aren't even considered parties to a determination case, despite their significant interest at
stake. The parent advocates for maintaining the relationship, and that's what the child wants, it's protected, isn't it?
I disagree, because, you know, we don't actually know what MS wanted in this case, and you know, the record shows that he at least wanted a relationship with his mother to continue, and that he wanted his relationship with his grandmother to continue, and that he wanted to be returned to home with his grandmother.
So the court was aware of that, notwithstanding the shortcomings of the guardian?
The court learned of these facts, correct, but there was no advocacy on behalf of MS himself. So what we have is parties advocating their views of what would happen, but the child's voice was absent. I want to talk a little about the 14th Amendment. There's a dispute on what standard of review we apply to the Matthews v. Shepard test. My position is that de novo review is proper because this is a constitutional issue. This is a legal issue for the court. I've also cited as persuasive authority, I think it's a case from Montana where they reviewed an issue of appointment of counsel, and they reviewed the Matthews v. Shepard's factors de novo. While my argument is that MS was categorically had a categorical right to an attorney, even under the lesser balancing test that we apply under the 14th Amendment, that test favored him being appointed counsel, and that applying a de novo review, this court should hold that he also had a right to counsel under the 14th Amendment.
Thank you. You have your 3 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Rachel King, co-counsel Ann Honrath, and myself represent the Department of Social and Health Services, Children's Administration.
Just one of you is arguing, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
This morning we are asking the court to affirm the termination of parental rights for three reasons. The first is that there's no basis for a separate interpretation of the Washington Due Process Clause, and that the current statute is adequate to protect children's rights. The second is that the trial judge appropriately weighed the Matthews v. Eldridge factors. And the third is that the trial court did not err when making its findings under the termination statute.
What's the standard of review of the Matthews test?
It's abuse of discretion, Your Honor, for two reasons. The first is that the MSR case directs that the trial court's discretion should be applied to determine whether counsel should be appointed, and that should be done by applying the Matthews v. Eldridge factors to assess how to apply that discretion. The second is that this is an extremely fact-specific question, as indicated by co-counsel's arguments. There's a lot of facts that go into what other parties are advocating, what their position is, how vigorous their litigation of this matter is, whether the child is able to adequately direct counsel and engage in the stated interest type representation that's supported by appellant's argument. So that the court's interpretation of those facts, the trial court's really in the best position to assess those, and that assessment should be given discretion. Additionally, I would point out that both this court and Division II in unpublished decisions have applied the abuse of discretion standard to this question, and I do have copies of those two decisions that my co-counsel will provide to the court at the conclusion of my argument. Unless the court has additional questions on the application of the Matthews v. Eldridge factors, I would turn back to the Washington Constitution argument and first emphasize that the existing statute is adequate because it permits the court to appoint counsel for those children who need it, where there will be a benefit to the proceeding.
On this gun wall analysis, isn't that something that the Supreme Court should be doing?
Yes. This court, of course, has the first opportunity to do that, but it certainly will ultimately be the Supreme Court to assess that question. And speaking of the gun wall analysis, I think it's really the third and fourth factors that are really persuasive in this case, and both indicate that there's neither pre-existing state law nor any kind of legislative history that would indicate that there was any contemplation that the Washington Due Process Clause would be any broader than the federal Due Process Clause when it was adopted. And even if the court looks to more recent case law, cases such as the Bellevue School District v. ES and the In Re Marriage of King case both indicate that there's no reason to interpret the state constitutional Due Process Clause any broader than the federal Due Process Clause. And in fact, to do so really would be an unprecedented expansion of the state Due Process Clause. It's not been done before. In fact, it's been repeatedly rejected, both in the criminal context and even specifically in civil right to counsel cases. That's Bellevue School District and the King case. And as the court's aware, Washington state courts are reluctant to expand the Washington Constitution beyond federal parameters, and such restraint should really be applied here, especially when the right that's being requested by the appellant is very broad. It's a categorical right for all children in dependency cases, and it's a self-executing right. That's my understanding of appellant's argument. That means kids aren't even having to ask for it. That's an even broader due process protection than what individuals are guaranteed in criminal proceedings. And contrary to the argument of appellant this morning, the outcome in this case is not controlled by the outdated pre-gun wall case law cited by appellant. That's the Lucier and Myricks case. And that's for three reasons. As I indicated, those cases predated gun wall. The second reason is that the federal constitutional underpinnings of those cases were undermined by Lassiter. And the third is that there was no separate analysis done to indicate that the Washington Due Process Clause is more protective than the federal Due Process Clause. So to assume that those cases mean that the Washington Constitution is broader would really be contrary to this court's jurisprudence following the Gunwale case, which indicate that expansion of any Washington constitutional provision should be done only with a very reasoned and careful analysis as to why there's a basis for doing so in that particular instance. And even if the court did decide to do an independent interpretation of the Washington State Constitutional Clause, the result really would ultimately be the same as the MSR case. The court would be interpreting the Due Process Clause. The manner in which we do that in this state is applying the Matthews v. Eldridge factors. That has been done by the Supreme Court. And in MSR, the court indicated that a case-by-case application of those factors in with the trial court's discretion is adequate to protect children's rights in these cases. Unless the court has questions as to that, I will return back to the application of the Matthews v. Eldridge factors in this case, which is what the MSR case directed that trial courts should do in order to ensure that those children who need counsel should be getting it. Now, the court weighed each of the three factors. It properly recognized that the private interests of this child, MS, were great, as were the government interests. Those interests included the welfare of the child, the right to an accurate and just decision, the child's need for stability and permanency, and, of course, the consideration of cost.
I think the parties are in agreement that the first two are strong. The real dispute is over the third, is there not?
Exactly. And there are certainly other protective factors in this case. There is the right to the full evidentiary trial before an unbiased fact finder, the right to discovery, the high burden of proof, that's the clear, cogent, convincing burden of proof for the termination statute, and as Your Honors have already alluded to, the participation of other parties. In this case, the social worker is represented by an assistant attorney general. The mother is represented by a court-appointed attorney who is very active in this case. And the guardian ad litem is a professional guardian ad litem who herself is an attorney and also independently represented by an attorney. So opposing counsel's argument that another voice would have contributed or somehow changed the outcome here is questionable, given that there's already three parties. And then, of course, the court itself also all working to protect MS's best interests. Other reasons why there really isn't any added value for an attorney for this particular child.
You agree in this particular case, though, that the guardian ad litem misperceived her obligations in the case?
It's true that the record reflects that she testifies she did not understand it to be her obligation to report to the court the child's stated interests, and it's clear that RCW 13-34-105 does require that. That said, she did, in fact, report the child's stated interest, which she learned through the child's counselor at RDCC, Ms. Scarborough.
But she never herself had a discussion with the child about that issue. You don't think that could have impaired her ability to represent what the child wanted, and could that not have affected the outcome?
Well, if Your Honor means represent just by report to the court, as opposed to advocate for, right, that's sort of a question here. But I don't think that that impaired her ability to represent the child's interests. And I think one of the things, a careful reading of this record indicates that this was a very difficult question for MS. It was something he could only really discuss in a therapeutic environment with his counselor at RDCC. So surrounded by a team of professionals who are carefully exploring this question with him.
Maybe he could have discussed it with a lawyer with whom he had a relationship that was confidential.
Certainly, and maybe he could have, but would that have added any value to this proceeding in terms of a due process right?
We don't know.
We don't know. I think the other important thing to note here is that MS's stated wishes, at least as were reported at trial, was to go home or to return to live with his grandmother, which unfortunately wasn't available at the time of trial. The grandmother was very impaired by a stroke she'd had earlier that year, and she unfortunately was not available to be placement for this child. And so the child's stated interest to return to his grandmother wasn't something that was available
there
at that time.
There was some suggestion that a guardianship could have been interposed as opposed to proceeding with termination.
Right. So first, that's not available because the grandmother's not able to be a guardian, to be a caregiver at all at that time. Second, the mother could have filed a guardianship petition. The statute allows any party to the dependency to file that petition. So MS not having his own attorney doesn't prevent that option from being explored. And, of course, if it was appropriate, the department could have explored it as well. And the social worker, in fact, did so. And also the dependency court itself had determined that that was not an appropriate permanent plan for MS. There had been, in a dependency review hearing, a prior decision that both guardianship and adoption should be MS's permanent plan. That was modified in March of 2015, so just months before the termination trial, to a sole plan of adoption, indicating that guardianship was not an appropriate plan for this child any longer. Unless the court has additional questions, I thank you for your time and would ask that the court affirm the termination on parental rights.
Thank you, counsel.
I think Your Honor's questioning about what we don't know is right on point, because that's the problem with this due process balancing test, which we do afterward. It's vague. We're sort of speculating on what would have happened had he had an attorney. What the categorical right to an attorney establishes, it eliminates that vagary.
It does, but that's not the question. It's whether it's constitutionally required.
That's correct. And, you know, my argument does rely heavily on the precedent of Lushire and Myricks. In those cases, hold that it's a categorical right to have an attorney in a termination of parental rights proceeding for the parent, and that's a sort of balancing test is not appropriate. And since the child has the same interest at stake, it's appropriate to extend that precedent and interpret Article 1, Section 3 in a manner consistent with that and give all children counsel. Counsel talked about MSR and how it established an abuse of discretion standard. I think MSR was talking about the statute. There's statutes that authorize courts to appoint counsel or not. This issue is whether the Constitution requires or mandates appointment of counsel, and that's a legal issue reviewed de novo. You know, due process, it's an evolving concept. You know, if due process hadn't evolved, we wouldn't have Gideon versus Wainwright. We wouldn't have the Lushire case, which holds that all parents are appointed counsel. And I've provided a Gunwale briefing, and the point of Gunwale is so that this court has a reasonable basis to interpret its provision differently from the federal constitution, that it's not just engaging in sort of its own policy preferences, that there's a reasonable a basis to do so. And the MSR opinion is not binding on this issue. There was no consideration of Article 1, Section 3 in that case. Going back to guardian ad litems, counsel talked about how the guardian ad litem was represented by an attorney. Not all guardian ad litems in these proceedings are represented by an attorney. Their training is not as vigorous as what you need to become a lawyer and licensed to practice law in the state. And in terms of the best interest of the child, what a lawyer does is he would advocate it, not necessarily so much for the best interest of the child, but what the child's actual interests are. And that's what was not covered here. And certainly the attorney would oftentimes also advocate for the best interest of the child as well, but he would primarily be fulfilling his duty to advocate for his or her client. So I'd ask this court to hold that all children are entitled to counsel under the Washington Constitution and to reverse the termination of Ms. Spahr's parental rights to MS.
Thank you, counsel.